Thank you very much, and good Sabbath to everyone. Let's go ahead and open to Deuteronomy 31. To begin the message today, I'm going to talk about something that's very familiar, I think, to all of us and to humanity in general, and it's the subject of fear. And fear is a feeling that everybody feels from time to time, resulting from a perceived danger or threat. Fear causes a change, actually, in our metabolic function, other organ functions, and it ultimately leads to a change in our behavior, and along with that, our thought process. It could produce avoidance, such as fleeing or hiding or denial from a perceived threat. Fear can result also in anger or in sadness or depression. On the other hand, fear can also motivate us to do something positive regarding a perceived threat. And so in and of itself, fear is not a bad thing. We are in fact designed to know fear, to experience fear, so that we will understand that we should avoid harmful situations. And so fear will help us to learn, has helped us to learn to pull your hand out of the fire so that you will not get burned. It will cause us to have respect for a mountain that we are about to try and scale, that we will look at the details of what is needed to successfully navigate through a mountainous pass. But when a fear of loss or harm overpowers the fear of violating safety procedures and ethics, this is when fear can lead to disorderly conduct that will eventually result in even more pain and suffering than we had initially thought. And that is what I want to talk about today, how to deal with the undesirable aspects of fear so that we can differentiate between being afraid and the need to be cautious, that is to show reverence or respect for something. And in this case, for the morals and the commandments of Almighty God. Because God tells us that we are to learn to be strong and to have courage. Now, when Israel stood on the borders of Canaan after wandering through the wilderness for 40 years, God directed them to go into the promised land, and they would be required to fight for it. He said to take up arms, to fight against the large armies, the seasoned warriors of the land of Canaan, to conquer their fortified cities. In addition, they were about to lose their beloved leader, a champion of faith, the prophet Moses. And the people of Israel were afraid. And in Deuteronomy 31, in verse 1, Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. He said to them, I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Eternal has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan. So the Eternal, your God himself, crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Eternal has said. And the Eternal will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and their land when he destroyed them. And the Eternal will give them over to you, that you may do to them according to every commandment which I have commanded you. And then he said, be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid of them, for the Eternal your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. And so we can make a comparison between the people of Israel and the words that were spoken in their ears and our calling, our journey. Because you and I, we are nearing the end of a long journey toward the God's promised kingdom. And the fear that those people felt is something for our heart, I think it's something for us to entirely understand. Because you and I have never had to face the battlefields of war. Nonetheless, even though you and I have not come face to face with bloodshed, the words that God related to them have just as much meaning to us today. And so all of us have things in life that we need to be courageous about. Each one of us needs to be strong in a variety of ways, either for ourselves or on behalf of another. Sometimes others, if we have a family or if perhaps in the workplace, if there are people under our authority. So we all face situations at times that might seem they are too difficult for us to handle. And so sometimes we find ourselves afraid, fearful. And the fear may not result in anxiety, as I had stated. It could result in sadness, in frustration, or anger, hostility. And it may even result in a lack of action. Apathy. We've heard the expression, paralyzed by fear. And we might not want to make a move one way or the other. But God has given us a way to manage and to face these situations, whether it's difficulty with work, whether it's difficulty with the family, perhaps a fear of health problems, of getting sick, of financial stressors, and even, as it says in Deuteronomy 31, in the face of war. And in this way, God also tells us and explains to us how we can deal with sin. Sin that can thwart our efforts to do well. And so whatever it is, we can learn to be strong and to be of good courage so that we can face these dreadful situations throughout our lives and to successfully navigate our way through them. And so let's go over to 1 Samuel 16 to look at a stellar example here. Much like the Israelites of old who were heading toward a promised land as pilgrims in this world, we are spiritual pilgrims, and we are on a quest for the promised kingdom of God. And so our pilgrimage, like theirs, is not an easy one, and it is destined to become more difficult as we near the end of the age. And so some of the atrocities that we hear about, that we read about, found in the persecution of various people around the world, the violence, the terrorism, the wars that are taking place, the famine, the hunger, the disease, well, these are in distant lands, not too close to where we live, but they will come close to home at some point. What will we do? How will we react? Will we be fearful? Or will you have strength and be of good courage? And so the time of Jacob's trouble relates that the cities, the suburbs, the neighborhoods of America, of Britain, of Australia, of New Zealand, and other civilized nations that are descended from those who received the birthright blessing from Joseph, that these areas will see war and suffering on their own land. But as we near these events, we can face the situations that will come with strength. And we can be brave, as the Israelites were instructed to do. And the first step is to believe that God is all-powerful. That sounds easy enough, doesn't it? But this means to not only believe in God, it means not only to believe that God exists, but it means to believe God, that is, to believe what he says. And so it's easy for any of us to say, well, I believe that God can do anything. You know, we understand he created the world. He can do anything he wants. But to know if he will do something or anything for us that is on our behalf, well, this is a question that we cannot always answer. And because of this, the best and the safest course for us to follow is to do what he says, to keep the commandments. Not just some of the commandments, but all of the commandments. Because, as the book of Psalms, or one of the books of Psalms relates, they are what defines righteousness. And so we read the story in 1 Samuel, in chapter 16, about the young man David. This man, at an early age, was willing to face what appeared to be an undefeatable foe, the warrior, the great and strong and tall warrior, Goliath. And we see the kind of strength and courage that David had, and all of us would look at him as a champion of faith, and we would like to have the same strength and courage. Well, we can. We can. Because even though we might feel distant from the champions of faith in the scriptures, such as Moses and David, we are not far from grace if we keep the commandments. And so David was the youngest of Jesse's sons. He stayed at home to tend the father's sheep while many of his older brothers went off to war to fight with King Saul. And when King Saul began to suffer from severe anxiety attacks because of his disobedience to God, Saul's servants were inspired to suggest some therapy for him, for the king. And 1 Samuel and chapter 16 and verse 16, "Let our master now command your servants," speaking to King Saul here, "let our master now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall be that when he plays it with his hand, when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, you shall be well, you shall feel better." And so Saul said to his servants, "Provide me now a man who can play well, and bring him to me." And then one of his servants answered and said, "Look, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a handsome person, and the Eternal is with him." And therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the sheep." And Jesse took a donkey, loaded the bread of skin, wine, and a young goat, and he sent them by his son David to Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him and loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And so it's not known how old David was at this point. Obviously, he was not a scrawny adolescent or a young teenager as many of the movies and the storybooks portray him to be. It says in verse 18 that this person who had known David, who had known of him, says he had seen him with his own eyes, that he's not only skillful, but a mighty man of valor, a man of war, it says. So obviously he was a strong young man at this point. And so God influenced the servant's suggestion here, and Saul's decision to send for David was something I think God also inspired. And he did this so that there would be an enormous lesson on display for the people of Israel. It could be witnessed by them, it could be recorded by them, and passed down to 1,000 generations. And David came and stood before Saul. He played music for him whenever the king was distressed. And if David could remain with him as a bearer of Saul's vessels, not just his armor, but his instruments here. Jesse agreed, and David was allowed to travel back home on occasion to take care of some of his responsibilities with the family. We see that as the story moves forward. But again, God was orchestrating these events, and it wasn't long after this that Israel was faced with a huge problem. In 1 Samuel 17, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Socho," which belongs to Judah. "And they encamped between Socho and Azekah and the Ephes of Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley in between them." You can imagine the tension of these two massive armies here gathered together, a war about to break out. "And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath." He was from Gath. "And his height was 6 cubits and a span." Now, a cubit is roughly 18 inches. A span is half a cubit, which is roughly 9 inches. And so it was that this man, this giant of a man, Goliath, was approximately 9.9 feet tall. Now, I am 5'8". if you were to duplicate myself and I stood on my own shoulders and then maybe minus a head, that would be about how tall Goliath was. You can imagine, just looking at me, how tall. This man was massive. It says in verse 5 that he had a bronze helmet. There they are, the props. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. Now, this means that his armor weighed about 150 pounds. That's a little less than I weigh. 150 pounds of armor alone. Now, it's not known if some of this was just for display. I'm sure some of it at least was used in battle. But a man of this magnitude, being very strong and a trained soldier, he would be able to carry around such armor. It says also that he had a bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. Now, this is a relative term because a weaver's beam could come in various sizes and lengths. But basically, it means it's a very big, round spear. It's not like a little one like we would throw, you know, something that can glide. It was much larger. And when you see the weight of the spearhead, you would see how it need to be much lighter. It says the iron of his spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Now, the weight of 600 shekels is approximately 18 pounds. 18 pounds. So I have here some weights, 5 pounds, another 5 pounds, another 5 pounds, and this is a 3 pound weight. Now, if you put these together, this is pretty heavy. That's just the spearhead. And he was able to throw this thing around because of his strength. And so we see that this massive warrior, standing nearly 10 feet tall, you know, the tallest man that ever lived was a man by the name of, let's see, I have his name here, Robert Wadlow. And he was measured at 8 feet 11 inches in the year 1940. Well, Goliath, according to the history books, was almost a foot taller than the tallest man on record. And so the sight of such a foe clad in armor, carrying this spear with a spearhead weighing 18 pounds, it would cause most men and women to be stricken with fear, paralyzed with fear, or perhaps to turn and run. But here's what happened. As the fear set into the hearts of most of Israel, and Goliath shouted the terms to settle the conflict here in verse 8, then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And you, the servants of Saul, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And so it's my belief that God designed this situation for Saul, for David, for Israel, and the Philistines, so that all who would see this event, all who would hear the story, read the words as we do today, would understand that this event, this has a moral principle for all of God's people to apply in a variety of situations. You see, Goliath can symbolize a big problem. A big problem for any one of God's people. And this man was viewed by everyone as insurmountable. Nobody wanted to face him. In the ranks of Israel's armies, not a single soldier had the courage to put their life on the line to face this huge problem. They saw it as a battle that could not be won. But David, on the other hand, he was a man of great faith, a young man of great faith. And this means he had more than belief. He did not only believed in God, David believed God. He had the evidence of the things that he had hoped for. And so he was a man of his word, a man of honor. He was respectful, and he sincerely cared for the well-being of others, including the nation of Israel here. And because of his faith, David had great courage. In verse 12, now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had eight sons. And the man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul, speaking of Jesse. The three oldest of Jesse's sons had gone to follow Saul to battle. The names of his three sons who went to battle were Eliab, and the firstborn, and next to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. And David was the youngest of these sons, and the three oldest followed Saul, and that means that they were soldiers. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem, and the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. 40 days, that's an interesting number, isn't it? It's a number that portrays trial and how to get through that trial. Israel was wandered in the wilderness 40 years. Christ fasted 40 days and 40 nights and overcame. In verse 17, then Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephod, this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare, how they're doing. Bring back news of them to me. And Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning. He left the sheep with the keeper of the things, and he went to Jesse as he had commanded him. And as he came to the camp, as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle, Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And in other words, they were poised for battle. They were, you know, making a lot of noise, but had not taken up an exchange of combat. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper. He ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. And as he talked with them, there stood the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. And this is referring to the words that we had just read in verses 8 through 10. And so David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and they were dreadfully afraid. And so the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that a man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. And David spoke to these men who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? In other words, consider what will be done. I mean, this man, he's defying God, the armies of God. The people answered him in this manner, saying, it shall be done for the man who kills him, according to the reward that we had read in verse 25. And now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and your insolence of heart, for you have come down to see the battle. So he was angry with David because David had courage, and he did not. He was the older brother. He should have had the bravery that David had, but he did not. And so he tried to ridicule David. And David said, in verse 29, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? And then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. In other words, they were all afraid. None of them had the courage like David had. And they didn't want to hear it coming from this young man who wasn't even a soldier in the army. And so the experienced soldiers, their hearts were pricked at this point. They may have understood that God was almighty, that he could do anything, but they lacked confidence in themselves. And I believe this is a result of their lack of faith in God. And so this caused them to fear Goliath more than they feared God. And the words that David expressed to these men were related to Saul. Saul called for David in verse 31. Now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. And then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him, because of Goliath. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." In other words, I will go. I will do it. And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." Now, it's not known, again, exactly what age David was. It's possible that he was under 20 years old, because Numbers, the book of Numbers in chapter 1 and verse 3 says that those who were 20 years and older would be eligible to fight in war. It's also possible that he was left out because he was the youngest of the sons, and where were the rest? Well, we know that here the oldest are soldiers already. Maybe it was out of kindness that they did not take all of Jesse's sons off to war. In any case, we see that David not only believed in God, he believed God. David said to Saul, verse 34, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep." He gave an example of his faith here, his confidence, not in himself, but in God. "And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and I struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing as he has defied the armies of the living God. And moreover, David said, 'The Eternal who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine.'" And Saul was impressed by this. And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Eternal be with you." And so David believed what God said. When God had previously said in Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 10, he said, "If you obey the voice of the Eternal your God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in the book of the law, and if you turn to the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul, the Eternal will make you abound in all your work of the hand, the fruit of your body, the increase of the livestock, and in the produce of your land for good. And he will rejoice over you as he rejoiced over your fathers." And in verse 7 of the same chapter, it says, "The Eternal your God will put all these curses on your enemies and on those who hate you and persecute you." And so Goliath stood here, representing all armies of the Philistines, persecuting the armies of Israel, the armies of the living God, at least the armies on earth. And so if they did not take action, the Philistines would further persecute the entire nation of Israel. And the fact that David believed the words of God that I had just read in Deuteronomy 30, and David acted accordingly, it led his behavior. And this, in turn, gave him a different perspective of the situation. While all others feared Goliath, David feared God. And so the armies of Israel saw Goliath as a problem that was unsolvable. But David saw God as a problem solver. And God desired to show himself strong on behalf of those who are loyal to him, as it says in 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9, "The eyes of the Eternal run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him." And this leads us to the first part of God's encouragement that we had read at the beginning in Deuteronomy in chapter 31, to be strong. And being strong is used in a wide variety of contexts. We can say that steel is strong relative to other metals. We know that iron is stronger than steel. A man or a woman can be strong relative to other creatures, relative to other men or women. But God is stronger than everyone. Nobody would argue with that statement. Well, at least no believer would argue with that statement. And so in this way, we see that diet and exercise, well, these things can be valuable and they can be extremely helpful. But the kind of strength that it would take to overcome Goliath and for us to overcome many of the obstacles that we face and life, that kind of strength does not come from something physical alone. It comes from God. It's an inner strength that is related to God's Spirit. And to build this kind of strength, as David has shown, it takes faith. And so when we make a sincere effort to live by God's commandments, it results in evidence of our faith. And God will then, therefore, in turn, be strong on our behalf because our heart is loyal to Him. And so we don't have to be afraid of the Goliaths that you and I might face in life. As David pointed out, what is Goliath compared to the living God? Nothing. Nothing. A parallel scripture for this to make this point is 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read it briefly. Paul encouraged Christians to watch, not just to watch our surroundings, to make sure that we watch the news, but to watch the self, to be aware of ourselves, our own behavior. And he says to stand fast in the faith, be brave, and to be strong. And so understand that the strength that you and I need to overcome the Goliaths of life does not come from us alone. In fact, we cannot do it on our own. When we are faced with such obstacles that seem to be unsolvable or overwhelming, we can look at the example of David. We can have the same perspective as David to keep the commandments, to live by faith. And so this, in turn, will allow us to overcome whatever might be standing in God's way. And, of course, in our way. Because it's a matter, if we truly, when we break it down, if we are faithful, it's really a matter of Goliath versus God. Who's going to win that battle? Well, we know who won, and so we know who to turn to when the problem is too difficult, overwhelming for us to solve. And so we ask God for help. We ask Him for Him to intervene in our lives. We can ask Him for more of His Spirit so that we gain wisdom. We turn our knowledge, our understanding to wisdom. But when we do so, we, like James pointed out, we ask with nothing wavering. In other words, don't go and break His commandments and then come to God expecting that we are going to receive anything. As it says in the book of Isaiah, on this person I look, on those who are poor and of a contrite spirit and who tremble at my word. In other words, who are afraid to break His commandments. Those are the individuals whose God's eyes are searching for to show Himself strong on their behalf. And so this is why David was successful in solving this problem that was much bigger than himself. David was strong. He was a strong young man. But defeating Goliath was not simply a matter of human strength. David had courage, but it was much more than being confident in himself. David found his courage, his confidence in God. Courage, as defined by the Hebrew term used in Deuteronomy 31:6, is the word amatz. And it means to be alert, physically, figuratively, to be on your feet, that is to stand up for what is right. Mentally, to be courageous, to be strong-minded, that is to have resolve, but not to be stiff-necked. Now, interestingly, Christ-related faith to having courage. When He healed people, He said several times to those individuals that were healed, be of good cheer. Your sins are forgiven. Be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well. And this term good cheer is the Greek expression thurseo, and it means to have courage. You know, we think of good to be of good cheer means to smile and just be happy. But really it means to have courage, to be brave. And when Jesus walked on the water, and the disciples saw Him walking on the water, He said to them, be of good cheer, have courage, it is I, do not be afraid, He said. And so David had strength in the Lord. He was courageous and convinced that God would fight this problem, would take care of this problem on behalf of the people of Israel. And this is the kind of maturity that you and I are to have. And this kind of maturity, it usually takes decades for people to attain. But we see David, well, he gained it at a very young age, a young man here. And Saul was moved by this display of bravery and faith, and he gave David permission to engage in battle with the warrior Goliath. In verse 38 of 1 Samuel 17, so Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. And David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them or tried them out. David said, I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off. In other words, Saul, we know, was a tall man. It says in 1 Samuel 9:2 that he was shoulders, head and shoulders above everybody in the land of Israel. So we know he was a large individual. So giving this young man his armor obviously was not going to work out. And so David, verse 40, took his staff in his hand. He chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand. And he drew near the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David. And the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him. For he was only a youth, ruddy, and he was good-looking. And so the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Eternal of Hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. And this day I will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And so anybody else facing this man that was nearly 10 feet tall, who carried a spear weighing 18 pounds, it would cause them to run in fear. But David, instead of running from the battle, David ran toward it, toward the danger. He was ready to face this huge problem for Israel. In verse 47, then all the assembly shall know, as he continues to say to the Philistine, all the assembly will know that the Eternal does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And so it was, when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag, he took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth. And so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in his hand, and that is in the hand of David. And so David ran and stood over the Philistine and took Goliath's sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Problem solved. And one wonders, I wonder how heavy Goliath's sword was. Now, obviously, it was probably a very large sword. Not too large for an individual to pick up, and kind of it would pretty much fall on its own to the ground to cut off this heathen's head. David was not a young boy. He was not of little strength. He was able to lift it up, and it even says later that he took the spoils of this battle to his tent, the armor of Goliath. Eventually, the sword that he used to cut off his head came to sit in the area of Nob. It was under the care of the priests in this area. And we don't know how it got there, but it's not really that important. The main point for us to recognize and to apply is the perspective that we see that David had. He understood that this battle would not be won by himself, that he was merely an instrument, that God would fight this fight, that God would win the battle. And this is the perspective that you and I should have when we face those difficult obstacles in life, the Goliaths of our lives, knowing that God's favor to be strong on our behalf will come if we are loyal to him. Luke chapter 12. As it said, the battle is the Lord's, and we are but soldiers in this fight against forces of evil. We have our part to play, though. We are told by Christ to be wise as serpents, to be smart about it, but harmless as doves. And we're also told in Luke 12, in verse 4, Christ said to the disciples and to us, "I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, and after that, there's no more that they can do to you." Well, that might be enough for some people. That's a fear enough to be afraid. But he's saying, no, you don't have to be afraid of that. This body is temporary. This is but our training ground. I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him after he has killed, has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. In other words, after the body is gone, that the life found in the spirit of man, that God is able to destroy that. And that's what we should be afraid of. He goes on to say that God will take care of us, giving this example. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 copper coins, and not one of them is forgotten before God? The very hairs of your head are all numbered. He knows everything. Everything about us, everything going on around us. Do not fear, therefore, for you are of more value than many sparrows. And so God will take care of our needs. He will provide for us. Doesn't mean that we don't need to do something on our own. We have to make efforts. We have to be, as Christ said, wise as serpents. Be smart about it. Don't be foolish. And this also does not mean that we should not be concerned about circumstances or situations that require our attention or our focus. But what it means is don't be afraid of them. Don't fear them, because the solution, as it says, is to fear God more than anything else. And the respect that we have for God, the respect that we have for his way of life, even the trepidation that should be felt to break his commandments, this will lead us to having strength, not in ourselves, but strength in God. And it will in turn give us courage to stand up for his right, to never give in, to bend our values because we might suffer loss. Psalm 183. There's an interesting example of this, found in an individual who was a citizen of Germany during World War I and during World War II. His name was Martin Niemöller. He was a World War I U-boat lieutenant who became a war hero to the German people. But after the World War I, he studied theology. He became a minister in the Berlin Dethlehem Church. After 1934, Martin began to lose confidence in the Nazi regime. And the reason was because he saw what was beginning to take place. And he saw an introduction of a kind of neo-paganism in the German culture. And he saw the Old Testament being abandoned within the church that he served. All pastors were forced to swear loyalty to the Reich. And those who were opposed to swearing loyalty to the Reich were imprisoned, and many of them were put into gas chambers. So Martin, he started an opposition movement, and in one of his last sermons given before being taken prisoner, Martin said, "We must use our powers," speaking of our strength, our voice, "to free from the oppressive hand of the authority like the apostles of old did. We are not willing to remain silent by decision of a man who, when God commands us to speak. So Adolf Hitler was obviously furious by his insolence and by this movement, and he had Martin arrested. He was tried and he was convicted of subservice actions, it says, to the state of Germany. Subversive actions against the state. And so after fulfilling this sentence that was related to the charge, Martin was released. And the reason is because he was admired by many of the German people. He was a war hero. But Martin continued to speak out against the Nazi regime. He was arrested again, and he was sentenced to 7 years. And at this time, he was sent to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. However, because he was an admired war hero, he was not put in among many of the other prisoners. He was held under protective custody, and it even says that he was held as a personal prisoner of the Führer. So Hitler realized that opposition that was found in the church at that time, it could stop if this influential man could be convinced to change, to advocate the cause as opposed to fighting against it. And so Hitler had sent a former friend of Martin to visit him in his cell and to try to convince him to join the cause. And when his friend arrived, he said, "Martin, why are you here?" And Martin replied, "My friend, why are you not here?" So Martin learned to have courage and to stand up for what is right, but it took time. He wished, actually, he had done it earlier than that. And he later had written in a poem that was published. He said, "First they came for the communists, but I was not a communist, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the socialists and the trade unionists, but I was neither, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew, so I did not speak out. And when they came for me, there was no one left to speak out for me." So bad things happen when good people are afraid and do nothing. And it's the same for us. When you and I go out into life, we get nervous about things. We're afraid to speak up sometimes for fear of persecution. Maybe we're afraid of losing our job. Maybe we're afraid of being attacked or ridiculed. Maybe we're afraid of insult or injury or getting sick. You know, sometimes we're fearful to leave the home because we don't want to, in flu season, we don't want to get out into the world and get sick. Now, sometimes it's not our fight. We don't always have to get involved. But we live in a scary world. We can't avoid everything. There is many things that we should be concerned about. And we don't have to be afraid. We don't have to be afraid when we stand up for what is right. If we believe that God has our best interest at heart, and we believe that God will never forsake us or leave us, just as promised, like David, we can have the same perspective when we face our personal Goliaths, understanding that God will be strong on behalf of us if we are loyal to him. And this in turn will give us strength and courage. David later wrote in Psalm 138, in verse 3, he said, "In the day when I cried out, you answered me and made me bold with strength in my soul." So God will answer the faithful when they cry out and help us to be bold, to give us strength and courage. But this does not mean that we should go out thinking that God is going to protect us from every evil, from all harm in life. No, we have to be wise as serpents, as Christ said. I was explaining this to my daughter the other night, that God has allowed this world to become a dangerous place. And it serves a purpose. He has allowed some of the angels to turn so that you and I would in turn need to face the thorns and the thistles of life and learn how to avoid harm. And he did this so that you and I would see firsthand what it is like to live in a world that where righteousness and keeping God's commandments, his ethics that is not the rule of thumb. What it will lead to. That it will lead to widespread pain and suffering. As history and as present times have shown, the way of the world is not the way of God. And look where it has brought us. War after war after war. Suffering and pain. Oh, we've seen good times. Yes, we have. We've been very blessed in this country to see more than our fair share of good times because of God's promise passed down from Abraham. But the wages of sin are death. And if those who are faithful were sheltered from everything, if we did not experience this firsthand, then it wouldn't seem that real to us. Oh, we would read about it and hear about it and maybe talk about it. But when we see it firsthand with our own eyes, when we experience it at times, well, it really hits home, doesn't it? We understand that we should be afraid of violating God's commandments and not fear those who come against, who fight against, who speak out against the ethics of the God of Israel. And so you and I need to experience all of these things firsthand, just like Christ. He came to this world to experience firsthand what it is like to be human, to know what it's like to feel the flesh that is weak, the flesh that is corruptible, and to learn to have confidence in God and his Spirit that is strong. And so we can boldly come before God's throne knowing that God will answer the petitions of our heart, but it requires something on our part. It requires loyalty. It requires faithfulness. And consider in 2 Chronicles 14, consider the example of one of Israel's greatest kings, King Asa. Some people pronounce it Asa. Technically, it's pronounced Asa, but it doesn't matter. I think we can say it in the English language. It sounds more appropriate, Asa. 2 Chronicles chapter 14 and verse 1, it speaks of Abijah, who he died, he rested with his fathers. Another scripture pointing to death is just a type of sleep, of rest. And they buried him in the city of David. And then Asa, his son, reigned in his place. And his days, there was quiet for 10 years in the land. Relative peace for 10 years after Asa took the throne. Why? Well, because Asa, as it said in verse 2, did what was good and what was right in the eyes of the Eternal, his God. And he removed the altars of the foreign gods and the high places, and he broke down the sacred pillars, and he cut down the wooden images. And he commanded Judah to seek the Eternal God of their fathers and to observe the law and the commandments. He also removed the high places and the incense altars from all the cities of Judah, and the kingdom was quiet under him. And this is what God expects you and I to do. I mean, we don't have physical idols in our life, right? No, I don't think any of us have anything that, or do we? Could it be that there are things that we put above God's law, things that we value more than God's commandments, and will allow those things that we enjoy to take precedence, move us to violating the commandments? Well, God, as the example shows, expects us to remove anything in our life that exalts itself to be equal with or above the ethics of God. And so we tear down these high places, if you will, tear down the high places in our mind, in our behaviors, our attitudes, our traditions, or our entertainment that opposes the values of God. In verse 6, continuing to explain what Asa had done, He built fortified cities in Judah, for the land had rest. And he had no war in those years, because the Eternal had given him rest. And therefore he said to Judah, let us build these cities and make walls around them and towers and gates and bars, while the land is yet before us. Because we have sought the Eternal our God. We have sought him, and he has given us rest on every side. And so they built, and the people prospered. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, and they carried shields and spears, and 80,000 men who carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. And so, and from Benjamin, 280,000 men. And so here he has an army of 580,000 men. That is impressive. Very impressive. And then Zerah, the Ethiopian, came out against them. And he had an army of 1,000,000 men. Wow. Almost double the army of King Asa. And they also had 300 chariots. And he came to Merasha. And so Asa went out against him, and they set the troops in the battle array in the valley of Zephathah at Merasha. And Asa, before he went out to fight, just like something and the example here of what we should do before we go out to do battle with the Goliaths of our life, he cried out to the Eternal as God and said, Lord, it is nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. Help us, O Eternal, our God, for we rest on you. We trust in you. In your name we go out against this multitude, O Eternal. You are our God. Do not let man prevail against you. And so the Eternal struck the Ethiopians before Asa and Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people who were with him pursued them to Gerar. And so the Ethiopians were overthrown, and they could not recover because they were broken before the Eternal and his army. And they carried away very much spoil. And so God was watching. He was willing to show himself strong on behalf of those whose hearts were loyal to him. And here we have one of Israel's greatest kings. And the society that he had established were people whose hearts were loyal to God. And it was evident in their keeping of his commandments. And so he fought for them. He gave them strength. He gave them courage. And they defeated all the cities around Gerar, for fear of the Eternal came upon them. And they were plundered all the cities, for there was exceedingly much spoil in them. In chapter 15, that's a new number. Chapter 15, it says, the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. Now, this man became a prophet. The Spirit of God came upon him. Of this prophet, we know little beyond these verses right here. But God sent this prophet to meet Asa, and this prophet said to him in verse 2, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, the Eternal is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. So God had previously said to Israel, I will not leave you. I will never forsake you. But we see there are terms to that. If we forsake him, he will forsake us, because he is not bound by the oath at that point. I mean, God made a covenant with Israel, and he makes a covenant with us. But there are terms of that covenant. We have to keep his commandments. And if we break them, if we choose to say, I'm not going to do that, well, God owes us nothing at that point. Out of kindness, maybe he will show us some favor if we repent and change. But we understand that breaking the covenant with him, forsaking him, is what led Israel to be divorced by him, as explained in the book of Jeremiah. And the book of Isaiah in chapter 59 confirms this when it says, behold, chapter 59 verses 1 and 2, behold, the Eternal's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins has hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear. In other words, he chooses not to hear. It's not that he can't. I won't. So sin, we see, separates us from God. And this much I think we know. Perhaps we should think about it a little more often than not. But this does not mean, though, we shouldn't think that every time we are suffering, every time we are facing a difficult trial, that we have sinned, that God is not hearing us. It's worth considering, obviously. But sometimes trials are designed, and God allows them. He even orchestrates them in our lives so that we can build strength, so that we can build courage. And there are opportunities for a fair share of troubles, our personal troubles in this life, when we choose to obey God. But if we are with God, he will be with us. If we do not forsake him, he will not forsake us. God can and will see us through. Matthew in chapter 10, recruitment posters for America's armed forces seem to emphasize seeing the world, having wonderful experiences of getting financial aid for college, and being viewed as a hero by the nation. But the truth is, enlistment in the military comes with serious risks. And many veterans know this all too well. Likewise, if God were to present his calling for Christian soldiers, those people who he is looking to become kings and priests in his kingdom, if he were to design recruitment posters for this calling, well, perhaps you might see some that showed some millennial settings, some of the peace that can be gained when Christ returns. But God does not try to paint a pretty picture, leaving out the harsh reality. God lets people know that devotion to him may require putting our life on the line. Matthew 10 and verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. In other words, be smart, but be sensitive. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils. They will scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now, some have confused this, thinking, you know, I don't really need to know the Scriptures. God's going to tell me what I need to know when it's time that I need to know it. But this doesn't mean that God is going to give us knowledge when we haven't even considered the knowledge that he spells out in the Scriptures. In fact, John 14 and verse 26 says that the Spirit will bring to remembrance those things that you have learned. And so we need to study the Scriptures. But don't be stressed out about it. That, you know, personally, I find it very difficult to memorize Scripture. I'm very good at paraphrasing and relating how they can be lived and applied. But I have difficulty remembering that. But it doesn't mean I don't study them. Oh, God willing, he'll give me in that time the words that need to be said. Well, Christ then said here that persecution and trials will get quite intimate. In verse 21, he says, brother will deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end will be saved. But when they persecute you in the city, flee to another. For assuredly, I say to you, you will not have gone through all the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. In other words, if they persecuted me, as he said in John 15, they're going to persecute you as well. It is enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher and a servant like his master. If they called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of his household? And therefore, do not fear them. Don't be afraid. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed and hidden that will not be known. So eventually, they will understand. Eventually, all people will be given an understanding of God's way of life. And they will look back on those that they persecuted and go, oh, I'm so sorry. And they will change. And that is when we will be able to go, I forgive you. Let's move forward. Let's go forward together in this. And that's the kind of peace that we can have, the kind of peace of mind, understanding that this is temporary. It's going to go away. Everything, our own bodies, will eventually fade. But God's character, the loyalty that we show toward Him, the faith that we gain, this will never fade if we do not forsake Him. And so we do know the scriptures relate, that the prophecies relate that it's going to get rough. But we can be tough knowing that it will work for good for those who are called according to God's purpose if we are faithful to Him. Because nothing that anyone can do can separate us from God, can separate us from our destiny. And we can overcome. Deuteronomy 7, we're going to end over there. Deuteronomy 7. I'd like to review again the comparison between us and Israel. Israel sought a good land. They sought a better life. And God showed them the way to attain both. And you and I seek another world, a better life. And God shows us the way to attain both. In Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1, when the Eternal, your God, brings you, speaking to Israel, brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Eternal your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, no show them mercy. Nor shall you make marriages with them. And you shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter to your son. In other words, the reason God explained this is He's saying, don't compromise your values. They will lead you astray. Leave no place in your life for sin. That is the example that is given to us. They will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. And so the anger of the Eternal will be aroused against you, and He will destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, burn their carved images with fire, because you are to be a holy people to the Eternal your God. The Eternal your God has chosen you to be a special people for Himself, a special treasure above all peoples on the face of the earth, just as we are called, as it says in 1 Peter 2:9, a chosen generation, a holy people, His own special people, God says. See the comparison here? All these things that happened to them were given as examples for us. The Eternal did not set His love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, because you were the least of all the peoples. And so God has not called the mighty. He has not called the well-to-do of the world, but the weak, as it says in 1 Corinthians 1:27. The weak, so that it will be known, not by our might or our power or strength, but by God's power shall these things be accomplished, as it says in Zechariah 4:6. But it is a journey, because the Eternal loves you. He would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers. The Eternal has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. But this didn't happen suddenly. They were not brought out all in one day. No, it took time. It was a trial for them, and as well as for the people of Egypt. And even after that, it was a journey, a long journey through the wilderness of sin. It took years of traveling in this wilderness. Why? So that they would be tested, as it says. God would test them whether they would walk in his commandments or not. He did this before they could enter the promised land. And like them, you and I are delivered initially. Our sins are wiped clean when we repent, when we are baptized, receive God's Spirit. Initially, we are set free from this bondage of sin, but it's a journey. As you and I journey through this virtual wilderness of sin, we experience the sins of this world. We see it firsthand. Why? So that he can test us to see whether we will walk in his commandments or not. And on this journey, we will face Goliaths. We will have to face problems that might seem to be stronger than we are. And alone, they could be. But with God, nothing is impossible. Remember the example of Israel. Remember the example of David and what God said to them. In verse 9, therefore know that the Eternal, your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps the covenant and mercy for those who love him, and, a lot of people forget that part, and keep his commandments. Look at verse 1 of chapter 8. Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Eternal swore to your fathers. You shall remember that the Eternal your God led you all these ways 40 years in the wilderness to humble you, to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And this is why they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. This is why you and I wander in this wilderness of sin. This is why Israel faced the Philistines. This is why David faced the giant Goliath. This is why you and I have to experience many of these difficulties in life, to humble us, to know whether we will keep God's commandments or not. And so the day or hour of Christ's return is unknown, but our personal salvation is nearer than when we first believed. Now is our time to show our quality, to prove our loyalty to God. Because you and I are each poised. We are in a position to qualify for the kingdom of heaven. But only those who overcome will be granted to sit with Christ in his throne. That is what he said. And how do we overcome? Well, it's certainly not by our own strength. But it includes personal ambition. It includes perseverance, a resolve, that it includes building character, it includes having courage to do what is right, even when it might mean loss or personal injury. And so have courage. I encourage us to have courage, because God will show himself strong on our behalf if we are loyal to him. God will see us through.